Hi there, I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane. If y'all are looking for a little American magic,
then put away your athames and wands and dig out your box of roots, stones, and bones.
This is New World Witchery.
On tonight's episode, Shapeshifting Revisited. Good evening, New World Witchery listeners. So, we just released the show on shapeshifting for our last episode, and while we normally do take some time to circle back around to the same topic twice, hence the 4-ish years between our two magical occupation shows, well, this time around, I had the good fortune of talking to a friend of mine who has a passion and a really broad knowledge of shapeshifting lore and traditions. He's both an academic, he is a cultural geographer, which he'll explain in just a minute, and he's a practitioner. So I think what he has to say will be of interest to a lot of our listeners. He was also kind enough to record one of his favorite shapeshifter stories, an Appalachian Jack tale called Cat and Mouse. So you'll hear that interview and a story. We'll have some music and maybe even a spell or two floating around in here tonight. Just a technical note, the sound quality from my guest's side is mostly fine, but you're possibly going to notice some occasional popping. I don't think that'll distract too much from what's actually being discussed, but my apologies if that does distract you and for not being able to clean that up a little bit more out of the file. Without further ado then, it's a pretty full episode, so let's return to full moons and the weird creatures of legend. On Werewolves, Witches, and the Warg Tree. A selected reading from Call of the Horned Piper, a tome of traditional witchcraft by Nigel Aldcroft Jackson. The magical techniques of wolf wizardry and lycanthropy seem to have revolved around the symbolic death of the initiate, mystical communion with the master of the underworld forests, and the death goddess, disrobing and passing over the water to the other side. The ritual donning of the wolfskin or traditional wolfskin belt with the seven-tongued buckle. The eerie, undulating chants of the wolf initiates combined with the effects of a salve of wolf fat and certain herbs. This all constituted an archaic magical discipline whose aim was to induce a state of altered perception in the initiate. In the wolf trance, the mutable energy field, or hamingia, would be liberated and the hummer, the etheric soul sheath or skin, would be projected forth in the form of a wolf as a vehicle for the shaman's consciousness. This experience also involved atavistic communion with the deeply buried animal soul at the level of the ancestral subconscious. Odin was held to be a master of such shape-changing arts, and advanced adepts who possessed great personal power could actually affect the perceptual consciousness of an observer, causing them to see their changed form. Likewise, seers and psychically empowered individuals could discern the shape-shifted animal forms of sorcerers and witches as they wandered abroad. In our most recent episode, we discussed shape-shifting in the North American landscape, and we got a really, really good response to that. And because of that, I actually found out somebody that I've been in communication with for quite some time that I consider a friend has some real experience and expertise sort of in the field of shapeshifter lore studies and things like that. So I asked him to come on the show, talk a little bit about what he knows about shapeshifting and discuss maybe some of the broader pieces of lore, some of the broader areas that I might have missed, which encompasses a lot of stuff, let me tell you. Shapeshifting is not a narrow, easy-to-define, one-and-done kind of discussion. You could probably create a whole other podcast series just about shapeshifting magic and shapeshifting lore and still, you know, fill quite a few episodes. So I have with us tonight, I have Akia Branvin-Shienach, I think I've got that right.
Yep, that's right.
Fantastic. Of Spellbound Bookbinding. I think I've got that right.
Yes.
Excellent. Who is, he's one of our first, supporters and first, friends, sort of, in our Patreon campaign as well. He, actually, if you listened to us talk about it on the last episode and, have been following us on Facebook, he does the leather-bound bookbinding for paperback books, which we've been talking about on the site and on the, show a little bit. So I kind of knew him through that. Knew him through discussions about all kinds of folk magic and things like that. He is a cultural geographer with a degree from Virginia Tech. He also is... are you a student or a dedicant of the AODA?
I'm a student of the AODA. I'm still in my candidate year, which has lasted me somewhere closer to four. I, as John Constantine says, I'm something of a petty dabbler in the various occult arts. So, yeah.
Yeah, jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah, a little bit.
Best way to go. I'm very much in that school with you. So, and you're also a devotee of the Morrigu?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, got a, kind of a wide, pantheon of sort of places that you're drawing from, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to, I think the one that for our audience is going to maybe be, not confusing, but certainly one that might need a little explanation is the idea of a cultural geographer. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that means?
Sure. Yeah. Basically what I do is I look at the spatial dimension of culture looking at the way that culture is displaced over a region, looking at regional difference in material and sort of social culture, that sort of thing. It's really applying that spatial dimension to almost an anthropological study of the world.
And so would that be, so that's maybe following something like, so for example, maybe following the development of barn types is one way of looking at that.
Oh, as yeah, that's a big thing. That would be a sort of the material culture side of things. Mm-hmm. I'm more attracted to, the linguistic and social, side of that.
Gotcha.
So like my minor, is in Appalachian studies. So I've really looked at like, I've really studied the region, and the cultures, plural, of the region, of Appalachia, mostly Southern Appalachia. So, that's kind of where I hang my hat is in Appalachian studies.
And so, as you said, you know, the linguistic patterns you might be following, for example, then, traces of Scots-Irish dialect or German dialect.
Stuff like that. And I'm also working on a project looking at the effects of cultural hegemony on language, on regionalized language, which is really, really cool study. So,
yes. And all of that is to say that you have the fancy pants degrees and things covered. You kind of know what you're talking about from that perspective. But you also have this lifelong fascination and interest in shapeshifting and shapeshifter lore, which is really why you're here. Don't get me wrong. I love cultural lore. I think that's wonderful. I'm a folklorist. Cultural geographers and I get along famously. But the shapeshifter lore is something that you've really got a passion for. And something that you've, really, you know, got some knowledge about. You, were, as soon as I published the episode, I get this message from you going like, I have so many resources for you.
Yeah.
So I want to hear more about that. So tell me more about where this fascination comes from you and, you know, how do you see that lore disseminated, particularly in the new world, but, you know, old world as well?
Okay. So, this was an interest of mine from way back before I would even have considered myself anything other than just a charismatic Christian. Like the very first book on occultism that I bought was Frank Hamill's human animals. It's always been fascinating to me. Part of it was I really associate with foxes, in a very, very powerful way. And that the sort of the way that I feel about foxes kind of drove me to look at, okay, well, what about shapeshifting? What is shapeshifting and how does it fit into the real world? That's kind of the spark of my interest in the subject.
Good. So you obviously are coming at this from a place of, as we said, sort of passion and interest. And as you mentioned human animals, can you talk a little bit about that book and kind of how it approaches the lore of the shapeshifter?
Yeah, it's basically an academic treatise from 1915. And we had kind of a laugh about how offensively ethnocentric it is because of the time in which it was written. But if you can get past that and look at like the meat of what he's saying, he talks about a lot about shapeshifting lore from all over the world. He goes into some minor detail about what shapeshifting actually involves in various cultures around the world. And mostly the book is just little anecdotes, one after another, of either legends or like actual historical accounts of shapeshifting. For example, there are several accounts of shapeshifting in medieval and Renaissance France that he discusses. Mostly it's dry academic stuff, but if you're an academic, then it's actually pretty fascinating. So.
Yeah, it reminds me, I mean, I'm sure people who listen to the show probably have heard of, or will hear of at some point in their discussion of, paganism and magic, Fraser's Golden Bough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it kind of reminds me a little bit of that, but much more focused. It's very, very, it's got a very specific, track that it's following, I guess.
I'm pretty sure Hamill actually references the Golden Bough a couple of times.
I have not read it all in extensive detail, but the little bits I have read from it they definitely seem to remind me of that. And it's interesting because he follows fairy tales and mythology. He kind of follows both branches and gives them both and folklore, folklore and legend as well. Gives them all kind of equal sway in terms of cultural relevancy.
Yeah, definitely.
So why do you think, coming at this, what do you make of the shapeshifter? Is it different by every culture? Does every culture, treat the shapeshifter differently? One of the questions that, Lane and I had kind of come up against was in a lot of modern renditions, shapeshifters kind of get pitted against the other monsters, things like vampires or whatever. I couldn't really think of a lot of like, pre-existing lore where a shapeshifter, would do battle with a vampire or something like that.
No, not really.
But I definitely can think of, a lot of, particularly the European lore, but also, there's, African lore of things like the Adze and the Ewe tribe, which is a sort of vampiric shapeshifting creature, where they're really considered like kind of the most evil of evil. Like they sort of take on traits of witches or vampires, as well as the shapeshifting quality. Mm-hmm. So do you see that sort of pervasively, or is that, isolated to a few cultures specifically?
The evil aspect of it really seems, this is just my observation from all of the lore I've gathered, the fact that it's evil really seems to follow in a general sort of way how built up civilization is around it. So the closer that a a particular culture is to the land, generally shapeshifting is less frowned upon. Whereas in more industrialized nations, the shapeshifting lore tends to be about, you know, evil, because, you know, the idea that you're being close to the wild and the wild is the other and the other is scary, is that that's kind of really, really big. But I primarily see that, with some exceptions, but I primarily see that in, like, industrialized places, places that have been pseudo-industrialized for, you know, 1500 years and then fully industrialized for the past 300.
So one thing you said there was if they're closer to the land, that it's a more positive relationship. Mm-hmm. So what do you make of the skinwalker phenomenon then? I mean, the skinwalkers are, you know, I don't want to create this sort of like idea of the noble savage or anything like that. I don't want to do that and sort of pigeonhole Native Americans or anything like that, because Lord knows that's happened plenty in our history. I don't want to do it again. But there is definitely a sense that, you know, if you're talking about like the industrialization aspect of it, you know, the Navajo are not, you know, particularly industrially oriented. But they certainly seem to see the skinwalkers with this very sort of frightful connotation. So what do you make of that?
Again, I tried to make sure I pointed out that there were exceptions, and the Diné, the Diné are definitely a huge, glaring exception to that particular rule. I really don't know where to fit that in. I know a little bit about it, not enough about it to really feel comfortable talking about it. Because I'm concerned about cultural appropriation, and I'm concerned, you know, these are very important beliefs to a people that I am not a part of. And so the understanding that I'm comfortable talking about it is it has to do with the witchery way in the Navajo hierarchy of folk magic. And it has to do with, dealing with, the Ngloshi, which are, from my understanding, please don't quote me on this. My understanding is they are first world spirits. That's really about as far as I'm comfortable talking about. So that they are spirits from a previous state of being, according to the emergent cycle in the Navajo, in the Navajo tradition, or at least that's my understanding. So in that way, I think it still somewhat follows the pattern of industrialization, but not really industrializing more. The Navajo are a fairly well developed culture. There's a lot of, you know, job specialization and things that you see in more, I hate the word advanced, but I don't know what other word to describe it. More complex. That's probably the best way to say it.
And very well defined. I mean, a lot of their ritual, as you're saying, you know, their cosmology is fairly well defined. Mm-hmm. Their ritual structures are fairly well defined. Their social hierarchy and order is fairly well defined. Mm-hmm. And one of the, you know, in thinking about the skinwalkers, one of the things I thought was interesting is that there is this sort of frightfulness that's attached to them in the Navajo lore. But I've also noticed, at least in a good number of the legends, the people who encounter them are people who are not permanent residents of the area. They're people passing through. I kind of wonder, like, if there is a way of looking at it, that maybe they're sort of the watchdogs or the guardians of that culture or that place. But that's, I'm obviously just speculating there.
Yeah. That's not, that, that's, that's, not And that's not an area I feel good. Like I said, I tried to tread as carefully as I can around the First Peoples and their beliefs. On the other side of that coin, there is a, you know, there's a strong wolf shape-shifting tradition among the Northwestern First Peoples. And that's actually kind of what inspired the stuff from Twilight. As silly as Twilight is, the stuff about the werewolves is, you know, at least partially based on existing an existing warrior cult that practices lycanthropy as part of their tradition.
I don't know. Part of me doesn't want to give Stephanie Meyer very much credit for research.
No.
But at the same time, I'm sure she did some research on that. And that's not fair for me to say that.
That actually brings up one of the other books that I'm really into, which is Monsters by John Michael Greer, which he actually discusses some of the stuff from the First Peoples. And before Stephanie Myers put pen to paper, his first edition of Monsters came out and discussed that tradition specifically. So
she may have been drawing on some of that same sort of well. No, that makes sense. Can you point us at some of these more positive shapeshifter models, and is shapeshifting, the rituals that I ever see for shapeshifting generally have, at least from the European context, they have that, diabolical pact element to them. You know, are there shapeshifting rituals that are more applicable for someone practicing today?
Oh, yes, very much so. Where to start here? This is a really, really big subject, and one of the primary reasons I contacted you. I guess I'll start by saying that I have actually done a little bit of shapeshifting myself. I did it once before I realized how dangerous it was, and I have not done it since until I actually have the magical chops to try it again. So the modern Western tradition of shapeshifting kind of goes back to Eliphas Levi, or Eliphas Levi. I've heard it both ways. He discusses, shapeshifting briefly in his Transcendental Magic. Then later the Golden Dawn, picked up some aspects of shapeshifting. Which actually is really interesting. You guys were talking about its relationship to glamour and invisibility in your episode. And in the Golden Dawn tradition, it is actually very, very closely related to those things.
Sorry, I'm taking notes as you say that. So what would be... not necessarily like give me a full rundown on the ritual or anything like that, but sort of, you know, what does it entail? One of the questions, you know, that kind of came up when we were doing the previous episode is a lot of the lore, for example, if somebody sends out sort of a witch cat, for example, they've taken on the form of a witch cat. If you cut off that cat's paw, all of a sudden you have a human hand and the person back home is missing.
Sopdal. I love Sopdal.
Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of so many versions of that same idea.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about shapeshifting, are you talking about, like, your physical body is compressed into, you know, a ferret? Or are you talking about that there is, an affinity, sort of magical affinity with a certain creature? Are you talking about sort of a projection of your, spirit or consciousness into some animal? You know, what do you sort of make of shapeshifting, you know, in practice as a cultural phenomenon and as, you know, a personal magical practice.
Well, okay, in Monsters, at John Michael Greer's whole point in setting down that book was to give people sort of a field guide to supernatural phenomena. And he kind of goes over what is involved in shape-shifting in that. And essentially, I think the way he puts it is, if it were physically possible to go through a metamorphosis like that, it would take months, and, you know, very, very painful, like caterpillar to butterfly cocoon sort of thing. So he sort of dismisses out of hand the idea of an actual physical transformation. But what he does discuss is, using what Eliphas Levy or Levi, terms the sidereal body, which is, you know, your aura, if I want to be sort of fluffy bunny about it, it's your etheric, your etheric projection around you into the world around you. And essentially there's two methods of doing it. The first is, as happens in most shapeshifting lore, the person goes into a trance or goes to sleep, and they're, through either use of hallucinogenic drugs or ceremony, they separate their sidereal body from their actual body, and project it out, and then transform that into whatever animal. And because the etheric body is so close to the physical realm, it can manifest in the physical realm, sort of the way that ghosts can manifest. And so it can interact with physical objects. And, but because it's a body of pure magic, that's why things like silver and fire and water have such devastating effect on shapeshifters, because you know, the conducting qualities of silver, kind of play havoc with the sidereal body and, kind of disperse it. So, the other method would be, this is much more similar to, invisibility, like, invisibility spell. So with the invisibility spell, especially as the Golden Dawn tradition discusses it, you know, you use your etheric body to create a barrier to vision. Like you discussed this a little bit in the last episode, you talked about how you can't actually prevent light from bouncing off an object and hitting someone's eyes, but you can sort of put a mental stop in between their eyes and you. And so you kind of create this magical cloak around yourself. And that is what causes you to be invisible. Well, the other method of shape-shifting is to wrap your etheric body around yourself in the same way, but instead of manifesting invisibility, you manifest the shape of an animal. One of the best examples of this from history, John Michael Greer discusses this in Monsters as well, is the berserkers of Icelandic and Nordic lore. Berserk means bear shirt. And so they are literally putting on a bear, the form of a bear, as though it were a shirt, and, you know, manifesting the aspects of being a bear, the sort of rage and, you know, ferocity and strength and, stuff like that in order to make them better on the battlefield.
So it sounds like, you know, we can certainly see the risks associated then with shapeshifting. Maybe not so much in the berserker example, although, you know, I guess if you've got the spirit of the bear and you're marching into battle, the risks are fairly obvious. But, you know, the idea that, you know, your magical body can sustain these wounds that then might, you know, sort of flow back upstream into you in some way. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of see the risks. What are the rewards? What do you gain by shapeshifting? That was something that was a little harder for us to nail down.
Well, Hamill, the sort of theme of Hamill's book, of Human Animals, is this idea of being close to nature and being close to, you know, feeling kinship to animals rather than seeing humanity as separate from the animals. So one of the biggest things for me, to shapeshifting is, you know, you're kind of getting in touch with nature in a very visceral way. You know, you can have ceremonies and stuff to, you know, honor nature and, you know, show your passion and compassion for nature in lots of ways. But by shapeshifting, you're really transmuting your soul stuff into a form that, you know, it's kind of solidarity with whatever animal you are taking on. And it usually involves, you know, a talisman made from the skin or hair of whatever animal you're taking on.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, that reminds me. Oh, go ahead.
Just to summarize it, basically, for me, it's primarily about connecting with nature in sort of a visceral, at the very core sort of way. But you know, scaring bullies also sounds awesome. So there's that too.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, except that then you've got battle fury on you and you need to, you must taste of the blood of man flesh. sorry. That might be an orc, not a berserker. So, yeah, that reminds me a little bit of some techniques I've seen in books by, for example, like Robin Artisan, where he'll talk about sort of this, you know, he couches it in this idea of deep ecology and the idea that you would be working with really, really immediate land around you and sort of there's a geographic region that you're sort of connected to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you read lore about shapeshifters, for example, you generally are not reading, you know, lore about a shapeshifter in Florida turning into a polar bear. Like, you know, there does seem to be a sense that you're going to be an animal that's immediate to that region and that there is sort of a bind or a tie to, you know, choosing and maybe not even choosing an animal, but maybe in taking the form of an animal that is appropriate to that region, that area. You know, what do you make of that phenomenon?
I think that people's magic reflects the land around them. I mean, that's pretty much what I do as a cultural geographer is I look at the relationship between people's surroundings and their culture. And I would definitely say that has to do with, you know, people changing into what is around them because that's what's around them. And so it has to do with that connection to the land and also a pure and simple convenience as well.
Mm-hmm. And then, so, you know, what do you make of the idea that, a lot of this, you know, this isn't just Harry Potter picking, you know, finding out your Patronus. This isn't that. This isn't quite totemic spirits either, necessarily. I'm sure there's a relationship, but it's not quite that. You know, does the magician, does the sorcerer, does the witch choose the shape-shifting animal that they become? Or is that something that there's a predisposition sort of extant? You know, is there are these certain forms that obviously get repeated very, very often, cats and rabbits, things like that. You know, is there a reason behind that?
If I had to guess, I'd say probably about 50% animals that people like, and about 50% it's the most convenient thing. So, for example, a witch turning into a cat, if the witch is known for keeping cats, then a cat will not particularly be noticed. And so they're less likely to be attacked by townsfolk for being a witch, or, you know, for the, on the other hand, the witch might really, 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 really like cats and say, hey, I like cats and I know a lot about cats. And so that, you know, makes me kind of uniquely qualified to know what it's like to be a cat. And so they use that as a jumping off place for their actual shape-shifting meditations and transformations.
Interesting. I wonder if there's also, you know, this is just me thinking as the fingers in the dirt sort of folk magician, but I wonder if there's also an element of, you know, it's pretty easy to get a hold of cat skin. It's pretty easy to get a hold of rabbit skin. It's not so easy to get a hold of polar bear skin, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And, I mean, unless you live around a lot of polar bears. So.
Exactly. And I mean, Hamill talks about the native peoples of like northern Alaska and northern Canada using shape-shifting techniques to hunt seals. So they'll wrap themselves in a seal skin and use that as sort of, you know, the focus to do a shape-shifting working. And then go and hunt seals. If folks in that area wanted to hunt polar bears, I'm sure they would also take a polar bear skin. But I think hunting polar bears is a particularly dangerous pastime, and that's probably why you don't hear a lot about polar bear shapeshifters.
Right. You know, I think I read something the other day. I was reading some background information for a fairy tale that I was doing that I'm hopefully going to be including in an upcoming episode. But there was something about a polar bear, and a polar bear, if it stands up on its hind legs, it can look an elephant in the eye. And I was that's a big bear.
Yeah.
So I was like, I don't see a whole lot of polar bears and elephants hanging out in the same spaces, but, you know, still an impressive statistic.
Yeah, definitely.
It's interesting to me that, you know, so you're obviously talking about, I don't know if that's Inuit or a different tribe in that area that's doing the seal shapeshifting. But, you know, it's interesting to think about, like, that's their take on the seal shapeshifting. But then, you know, in Ireland, you've got the Selkies, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And that's obviously not so much related to hunting seals. I mean, there is some history of hunting seals, but it's not as prevalent.
Well, Selkies are a little different because rather than a human becoming an animal, it's an animal becoming a human. And that, you know, Hamill explores that as well. Like, there's a big tradition of that in Japan with foxes.
The kitsune is.
Yeah, the kitsune being able to shapeshift into a human being. And stories of very similar, very reminiscent of Selkie stories, where the Selkie woman marries a man who hides her skin. You have kitsune women marrying men, and then eventually missing, being a fox, and leaving. So you see that sort of pattern repeated there, which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, there's actually a movie I just watched. It's not even a long movie. It's like a 20, 30 minute long movie that you can find on Amazon Prime called Foxes.
Oh, really?
It's actually the opposite. It's the other way around again, where it's the human becoming an animal, but it's a woman, in a very difficult situation, slowly becomes, over a course of a certain amount of time, becomes a fox. Mm. So it's an excellent short film. Just that made me think of it. Well, that takes us to, you know, a good place to kind of start, you know, wrapping this up. You know, what are your favorite shape-shifting tales? What are your favorite kind of bits of shape-shifting lore? And do you differentiate between, you know, some of these, you know, the folk tales that we're talking about, the shape-shifting folk tales, and something like, was it Io being turned into a bull in Greek mythology, or, you know, Nebuchadnezzar and
the Old Testament? I was actually going to mention Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is one of the most interesting shape-shifting tales because he, that's sort of a pattern that you notice is people being turned into another shape as a punishment. Mm-hmm. You see it a lot in Celtic folklore. There's a Celtic story about of some people who were turned into swans for like 150 years because they pissed off some particular sorcerer. And Nebuchadnezzar is kind of in that same vein. He was transformed into sort of what bovanthropy. He's described as becoming like an ox and eating grass like an ox for like a year and a half or something like that, or 7 years. It depends on which translation you look at. But yeah, that's definitely one of the most interesting pieces of shape-shifting lore I've found. But yeah, if you don't mind, I would actually love to share my one brief experience with shape-shifting.
Yeah, please do. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
So I had been studying this for a while, and I had kind of gotten to the point where I understood the idea of the sidereal body and, you know, and figuring out that I needed some sort of talisman and stuff like that. So I decided one night that I was just, you know, screw it all. I'm just going to try this. You know, it's sort of a here, hold my beer, sort of, situation. So using the, liminal space that is between waking and sleeping, I actually detached my, sidereal body from myself, shaped it into a fox, and walked down my stairs, down the stairs in my house. And then my, you know, I got maybe 20 feet from my body, and then I just snapped back to myself and woke back up. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those experiences that you don't forget. And one of those experiences that was really, really cool. But also, you know, I didn't get very far, and I kind of realized after the fact, you know, that was kind of very dangerous, and I'm not going to do that again until I know what I'm doing a little better.
And so you said until you know what you're doing a little better, is it something that you've approached again since then at all, or is it something that, you know, you're building to?
It's something I'm building to. I really want to finish my stuff in the Ancient Order of Druids, earn my first degree. And then I'm going to switch over to another order run by John Michael Greer called the Celtic Golden Dawn, which is kind of a Celtic spin on the Golden Dawn tradition. And in the Celtic Golden Dawn, he has some stuff about shapeshifting. But it's very, very far into the system. It requires a lot of work to get to that place. I will do it again someday. But for now, it's something that I hold a passionate interest in. And that's about it.
Gotcha. Well, and did you have any favorite, so Nebuchadnezzar is kind of one of your favorites, you know, in there. Is there any, you know, is there any form or sort of cultural shapeshifter that you are particularly fascinated by?
Being a druid in the modern druid tradition, I think probably the biggest one would be Taliesin. You know, the story of Gwianbach stirring Caradhwen's cauldron of all knowledge and accidentally spilling 3 drops on his finger and then going through a series of shapeshiftings to try to get away from Caradhwen, who is very upset with him for stealing her potion. And, you know, it it's used as, in the modern druid tradition, it's used as, you know, kind of representative of the transformation of the self into a better self, if that makes any sense. But yeah, so definitely Taliesin. I'm also quite fond, you know, being a devotee of the Morrigu. You get a lot of shapeshifting in the old Irish folk tales. And you even get some like legal stuff going on with the tale of the Sons of Tuaron. The Sons of Tuaron are sent to kill Cian, father of Lu. And Cian shapeshifts into a hog to try and get away from them. And then they shapeshift into hounds in order to sniff out the hog that is not a real hog but is a shapeshifted druid. And they catch him, and then Cian says, "Okay, you've caught me. Let me change back into a man so I may die as a man." And he changes back into a man, and he says, "Ha, you let me change back into a man. If you'd killed me as a pig, you'd have only had to pay for a pig. But since you let me change into a man, now you have to pay for my death as a man."
Right.
So I thought that was really, really interesting, that it was, the idea of shapeshifting was so pervasive that there were even sort of legal precedents for killing someone when they're shapeshifted versus killing them while they're a human being.
Mm-hmm. No, that is fascinating. It's very interesting. I know in the in New World lore, you know, it's obviously the Celtic side of things is very deep and mythological, but I know that there is at least one sort of southwestern tale about a pair of basically brujos who get into a wager about which one in their horse form is the fastest, and so the loser has to stay a horse, but then like eventually basically does the whole the Guianbach thing where he takes on multiple forms. After somebody removes his bridle, he keeps changing forms until he finally becomes a coyote. But then in coyote form, he's hunted down by dogs and killed. So doesn't quite work out the same way it does in mythology.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there is a, you know, is there a difference between shapeshifters in mythology and a difference between shapeshifters in these more sort of broadly disseminated, folksier sort of iterations of the stories?
Yes and no. I think that real life imitates art and art imitates real life. So I would say that there's probably a reason that shapeshifting is so widely disseminated in mythology. And that would be that there's a precedent for it in real life. But generally in mythology, the shapeshifting is more immediate and more sort of like actually real, as opposed like physical transformation, as opposed to using the sidereal body, which suggests that it is probably representative of a spiritual journey, of something that maybe happens in the astral plane or something along those lines, as opposed to something that happened on the actual physical plane of existence. Probably my last favorite tale would probably be another Jack tale. So Sopdal is one of the biggest, one of the most famous Jack tales in the Appalachian region. But another one, slightly less well known, is called Cat and Mouse. And it kind of addresses one of the questions that you guys were asking about throwing your consciousness over several animals. So the idea is Jack meets this woman and her sister who have been changed into a cat and a mouse. And the one sister who's been turned into a mouse, if you become, it says, if you become a mouse, you can never turn back into a human. And the other sister is like, so, but I'm only a cat. So if you can defeat this witch, you can, I can be changed back into a human being again. And so this witch sends, all of these animals, again, like to attack, Jack in order to prevent him from shapeshifting the girl back into a human being. And so she sends animals for 3 nights and then she comes to herself. And so it's a really, really, really fascinating story and one of my favorites, especially with my Appalachian focus. So.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah, I do enjoy the Jack Tales. They're always, it's always, fun to see. I don't know, Jack's just such an interesting figure in general, just because he has that trickster side, but he's also the fool sometimes. It's just, he's a very interesting amalgamation, not even amalgamation, he's just a very interesting iteration of a few different figures, so.
You get Lazy Jack and Smart Jack. Lazy Jack tales are usually, you know, Lazy Jack was so lazy that he, you know, cut a hole in his seat and put a bucket under it so he didn't have to get up to go use the restroom.
Right.
Sort of, you know, being clever at being lazy is how the Lazy Jack tales generally go, which are great.
Right. That's that Brer Rabbit-esque sort of trickster kind of thing. Yeah, but that takes us. That's a talking animal. Brer Rabbit is definitely a talking animal. That takes us far afield of where we're going. I really thank you so much for this. Is an illuminating subject. There's so much more that we could probably say.
Oh yeah.
But I really appreciate you coming and talking to us about this. Now, if somebody had, for example, a copy of Human Animals in paperback, and they wanted to make it look really, really nice and perhaps get some sort of shape-shifting enchantment charm imposed upon that. Do you know anybody that I could recommend?
I don't know. I mean, well, there's this one guy. And that would be me.
So tell us a little bit about that side of, you know, you've done, I've got this really gorgeously bound copy of, 54 Devils, which is my cartomancy book, which is, you put little tiny devil horns on all of the pip shapes. I just am so fascinated. I just love that. I'm just looking at it right now. I love it. Tell us a little bit about that. If people want to get that done, how do they get in touch with you? You know, share your passion, share your skill.
Okay. So basically, it all started when I really wanted a leather-bound version of the Book of the Great Queen by Morpheus Ravina. But I had missed her GoFundMe campaign, or whichever one of the many crowdsourcing campaigns she used, in order to pledge enough to get a leather-bound version. And so I'm like, well, crap, I really, really want this leather bound because I'm a devotee of the Morrigu. So I actually had this idea to, you know, use the paperback as kind of the template and put a leather binding on the outside. And so I did that and it was so much fun. So I have done it for you and I've done it for that. And I would love to do it for your listeners. And I don't just bind the book. If you are interested in it, I can also put an enchantment on the book, to accomplish a certain, magical goal. If you want to talk a little bit about the enchantment I put on yours,
Well, you're the one who put the enchantment on it. You tell me. I mean, you did it. Sorry, that was a deck of cards falling down appropriately enough as I'm grabbing it. So you inscribed it with a Latin incantation, or I guess it's not an incantation, I guess it's unless it's incanted and spoken. But and then you also, I believe, bound into it some, I don't want to say it's a psychic boost necessarily, but it's kind of that idea where it sort of increases the sort of clairvoyancy aspect of our using it.
I made a clairvoyance oil, mm-hmm. and I like treated all of the leather with that, and then I inscribed a charm on the front cover, which I actually did the incantation myself once for, you know, for each of the 54 devils, and, you know, it kind of laid layer after layer of the enchantment on it just to give it that extra boost so you can use it as sort of a psychic focus during a cartomancy session. And that's the sort of thing that I would typically do, with, like, if someone had a paperback grimoire that they wanted to get bound, then I could bind it for them. And if they had a particular purpose that they wanted to use that grimoire for, then I could use it as I could create a spell and enchant it, as a focus for that purpose. So, It's pretty much as simple as that. I bind it and then I enchant it, and it looks awesome. So,
it does indeed. As I said, you put tiny little devil horns on all of the pips on the cover. I can't tell you how gleeful it makes me when I look at that.
So if folks want to get in touch with me, they can find me at my Facebook they can find me at my Facebook site. Which, if you will give me a second to look that up.
When you first started saying that, I for real thought you were about to say your MySpace page. I was going to be like, we have to have a chat about technology.
No.
It's cool that you're leather binding books, but we need to talk about the digital language.
If my tablet will pull up my page, Spellbound Bookbinding. And if you just search Spellbound, all one word, Bookbinding, all one word, in Facebook, my page should come up. I'm pretty sure Corey will probably put a link to it in the show notes.
I can be persuaded, yes.
And if you want me to do something for you, I am doing a promotion for the listeners of the show. You contact me through a private message on my site, and I will bind for the cost of materials and shipping only.
That is a hell of a deal. I mean, it's got to be a labor intensive process, and I know the spellcraft involved with it is a labor intensive process, having done spell work before. You know, so that is really awesome of you to do that. And we really, really appreciate you making that available to our listeners. Is there kind of a hard out on that? Like, do they need to get orders to you by a certain date to make sure that can happen?
There is a soft out on that. And the soft out is the end of the Yule Christmas holiday season.
Gotcha. Okay. So, like, maybe like December 31st would probably be a good, like, date to have in mind.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Perfect. Well, cool. Well, again, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Is there anything else that you want to add or share or, you know?
Just give a shout out to my sources. So we have, the most recently published copy of Frank Hamill's book is actually called Werewolves, Bird Women, Tiger Men, and Other Human Animals. And that's by Frank Hamill. I have also used, Monsters by John Michael Greer. Mm-hmm. The Celtic Golden Dawn by John Michael Greer, by Oak, Ash, and Thorn, Modern Celtic Shamanism by DJ Conway, Circles of Power by John Michael Greer. Those are some of the best sources for a sort of more practical approach to modern shape-shifting lore.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We'll try to put all that into the show notes, just so people will have those resources available. Kia, thank you again. This has been awesome.
It's been a pleasure and an honor, Corey.
Honor and pleasure is mine, sir. Well, all right. Well, we'll head out and say thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Three shape-shifting spells, taken from Judica Elish's Encyclopedia of 5,000 Spells. Spell number one, an animal shape-shifting spell, the Russian Wolf. One, go into the woods and locate a smooth tree stump. Pay attention to which direction you've used to approach it. Two, stick a copper knife into the stump. Three, somersault over the knife. This will transform you into a wolf. To transform yourself back to your original form, approach the tree stump from the opposite side, somersault backwards. If the knife has been removed, you're out of luck. Spell number two. Twist yucca fibers into a hoop. Jump through it to shapeshift into animal form. Jump through it backward to transform back into yourself. Spell number three, an Italian werewolf transformation spell. The wolf, now virtually extinct in Italy, was once the totem animal of Rome, sacred to many Italian deities including Diana, Faunus, Feronia, and Mars. This spell is reminiscent of shamanic initiation rituals. Although not specified, presumably one should fast, or otherwise purify oneself in the days leading up to the spell. Simply sleep outside during a full moon Friday. You will either transform into a werewolf or be attacked by one.
So I'm fixing to tell y'all another one of them stories about Jack. This one's called Cat and Mouse. One time, the boy's daddy decided he'd give him $100 apiece, and then let him go out by themselves to see what they would do with it. Told him to be gone 1 year, and then to come back so he could see which one of them made the best of his money. Well, the three of them set out together down the big road. Then Will says, "Now, when we come to where the road forks three ways, we'll separate. There ain't no use in us going all together." So when they came to a crossroad, they stopped and talked a while, and directly, Will called Tom off to one side, and they went to whispering. Then they both came over to Jack and thronged him down and took every cent of his money, divided it, left Jack laying there. Will took one side road, and Tom took the other. Now Jack got his senses back pretty soon and sat there a little while trying to study what to do. Then he decided he'd go and see what luck he might have. So he walked down the middle of the crossroads, throwed his hat up in the air. Whichever road it landed on, he was going to go that way. Well, his hat landed on the road straight ahead, so he took it, and on he went. Now it was an old road, not traveled much, and pretty soon Jack was way out in some lonesome wilderness of a place. Went on and on, the road pretty nearly covered up with grass and briars, and directly he came to a fine-looking white house out there. Jack could see signs of somebody living there, and he had to have some place to stay the night. He hated to holler, 'cause he was so ragged and dirty, but he allowed there was nothing like trying. So he hollered, "Hello!" and waited a while. Nobody came out. He went to the door and pulled the doorbell. The door opened and a big cat came out. Now Jack didn't know what to think of that. The cat just sat there looking at him, and there didn't no person come to the door. So Jack hollered again, "Who keeps the house?" "Cat and Mouse," says the cat. "Law me," says Jack, "I done got to a country where cats can talk." "Yes," the cat told him, "there's an old witch out here. She got all my family but me and my sister. She witched her into a cat and then to a mouse and me into a cat. She'll try to witch me into a mouse tonight." Then Jack looked and saw a mouse creep out one side of the door and says, "Well, is there anything I can do to keep the old witch from bothering you?" Probably might be, says the cat. You can help me, but my sister, she'll stay a mouse. There can't nothing be done for you once she gets you into a mouse. You stay here by the door tonight and kill any kind of big varmints you see, and it'll keep the witch off. Well, Jack just went out and cut himself a big old club and got before the door and waited for dark. And when it got plumb thick dark, all sorts of bears and panthers and big wild animals come up the steps, and Jack could knock 'em down and beat 'em up with his club. He kept on fighting all night, must have killed 1,000 bears and panthers all that night. Next morning, that cat came out, and it was a little bigger and looked a little bit like a girl. Now tonight, she says, the old witch will send some middle-sized varmints. You see, you can keep them off, too. Now, Jack picked around that day and got what berries and such could be found to eat, cut him a middle-sized club, and when it commenced getting dark, he got in by the door again. Then all kinds of poison snakes and wildcats and weasels and boomers and groundhogs came and tried to get in. Now Jack hit at him with his club, knocked him plumb off the porch, and kept a-giving it to him and giving it to him till daylight. Well, he must have killed 100,000 of them middle-sized varmints all night long. Then the door opened, and that girl came out. She was pretty near the right size that time, but she still had some signs of a cat's claws and whiskers and ears. She says to Jack, "You done fine last night, Jack. Now tonight, she'll send all sorts of little varmints. You'll have quite a time of it, I expect." So Jack eat a few blackberries and huckleberries that day and whittled him down some paddles and swatters and took up his stand by the door when night came. And all sorts of poison scorpions and insects and spiders and hornets and big old ants came up and tried to cross the door still. But Jack went to work with his swatters and his paddles, and it was a sight in the world how he went after 'em. He thought there'd be a pile of dead things there when it got daylight, but when it got light enough for him to see, there wasn't a thing there on the porch. Then the door opened. And there stood the prettiest girl you ever done looked at. Well, she just had brown hair and hazel eyes. And when she smiled, you felt like you're looking straight directly into the sun. "You did real well, Jack," she says. "You come on in the house now, and I'll fix you something to eat." Now she baked Jack some cornbread and fixed him some coffee, and while he was eating she says to him, "Now you won't have nothing to contend with tonight but the old witch herself. You got shed of all the plague she had. Now when she comes in, you be sure and not let her do anything in the world for you. I'll hide, and you and the old witch can go to it. You remember now, if you let her do one thing for you, she'll witch us both into cats." So, that night, that girl went and hid somewhere, and Jack, he found him a needle and some thread and pulled up for the fire and went to patching his old raggedy coat. Wasn't long till a little ugly old wrinkled up woman came a hobbling in the door, looked like she was about 100 years old. Her nose and her chin was so long they hung down a wobbling. She got a chair, pulled up close to Jack, and says,
"Howdy do, Jack."
"Howdy do, ma'am."
"Let me do that for you, Jack. It looks so awkward seeing a man try to patch."
"No," says Jack, "I'll do my own patching." Now the old witch looked sort of outdone, but Jack kept right on, and directly he got up to fix him a little supper. Got some meal and a pan and started mixing bread.
"Now come on, Jack, let me do that for you at least. I never did like to see a man try to make bread."
"No," says Jack, "I can fix bread all right." Then he went to the fire, raked him out some coals, and set the skillet over him. Then he cut some meat and started it frying.
"Come now, Jack, let me tend the meat for you. I never saw anything so awkward as a man trying to cook. No, thank you, ma'am, says Jack. I don't want you messing with my meat. I'll tend it myself. Well, when Jack turned around to get his bread, that sneaky old witch got hold of the knife and went to turn Jack's meat over. There was an old flesh fork hanging there, a big old cast iron fork as black as coal they used to cook meat on. Jack grabbed that up and ran at the old woman with it, hooked her and rammed her right on in the fire. He held her down between the back log and the forestick, and such a cracking and a popping and a frying and a singeing you never done heard. Jack kept her there until she burnt all up. Then there stood that girl just a laughing, says, "You sure got her then, Jack. There'll be no more witchery done round here." So she fixed Jack a nice supper, and the next morning when they went out, that place was just full of fine livestock, chickens and hogs and sheep and cattle and horses, and the road was cleared out, and the crops was all standing in the fields. Now that girl says to Jack, "Everything here belongs to you now, Jack, for killing that witch." "You too," says Jack. "Well," she says, "yes, if you say so." "I sure say so," says Jack. "You're the prettiest thing on this entire property." So they went and got two fine horses and hitched them to the surrey, and went to the store and got Jack a new suit of clothes, and then found him a preacher and got married. Jack, he went to work about the place, tending to his crops and his livestock. That young woman, she cooked and did the washing and the milking and the churning and all. And then Jack got to studying how the year was about up. So he told the girl about how he and Will and Tom had started out and said they better fix up pretty soon to go back and see his daddy. So they got ready and pulled out with the team and buggy one morning. Now, Jack had got his old clothes and throwed him in under the seat. That girl had a pet fox, pretty as can be, and they took it along, too. They came inside of Jack's house, and he says to her, "You wait here a minute. I want to see what all's done happened while I's gone. See if Will and Tom got back yet." Then he put on his sour, dirty, raggedy, smelly old clothes, put that fox under his arm, and went on to the house. Now his father saw him coming, and came out to the gate and says, "Hello, Jack, glad to see you. You look like you must not have had any luck. I see you got that same smelly old suit of clothes on." "Will and Tom come yet?" Jack asked him. "Well, yes, they got in early this morning. They got new clothes, and both of them married nice-looking women. You wait here, Jack, and let me go get you one of my suits of clothes so you'll have something better to wear than when you come in." "Nope," Jack told him. "I'll just go ahead like I am." So he went in the house, and when Will and Tom saw him in his same smelly, ragged overalls and coat, they commenced to laughing and making fun of him. And their wives, they slipped round and pinned dish rags to his coattails. But Jack didn't pay no never mind. He talked to his daddy and his mama a while. Every now and then he'd squeeze down on that fox and it'd say, "Gold enough, but none for you." Will and Tom, they couldn't understand that. Then directly, Jack went back to where he'd left his wife. He got his new suit of clothes on again, and then him and his wife drove the surrey on down to the gate. He hitched the horse, and Jack took the pet fox under his arm. Now Will looked out and saw him and says, "Well, who's that?" Tom came and looked and looked. After a while, he said, "Ain't nobody we know. Is rich folks. What you reckon they want?" Now their wives, they came and peeked around the door. About that time, Jack's mama looked out the window and says, "Why, that's Jack." "No," says Will. "Why, that can't be Jack." Well, yes it is too, says Tom. It's Jack, and look what a pretty fine dressed woman he's got. Law me, says Will's wife. It'll not do for her to see the way I am. And she ran and hid under the bed. Then Tom gave his wife a shove and says, you run hide somewhere quick. Don't let her see you in that old cotton dress. And she jumped off the porch and crawled in under the house. Jack brought his wife on in and made her known to his daddy and his mama, and Will and Tom just stood around. Finally, Jack's wife says to him, I thought Jack told me you boys was married. Now where's your wives at? Mine's under the bed, says Will. She can come out if she wants to. So she crawled out from under the bed and had feathers and dust in her hair, and her hair was sticking straight out from her head like she'd plumb been struck by lightning. Then Jack's woman asked if the other'n was home, and Tom's wife, she scrambled out from under the floor with her hair full of trash and dirt all over her. Jack's wife spoke nice to him, and they talked on a while. Jack squeezed down on that fox directly, and it said, gold enough, but none for you. And by that time, Will and Tom knowed what it meant. Well, Jack took his daddy and his mama back with him and his wife, and they was all independent rich. Will and Tom never did do much good, and Jack and his wife and his folks, they lived happy. The end.
That's it for us tonight. I hope you enjoyed that sort of journey back into the moonlight and the mystery of shape-shifting. Again, there really is so much that can be said on this topic. It's not something that, again, can be one and done, and that's all that we'll ever say about that. You know, just in this episode, you've had the experiences that Akia mentioned, as well as some spells and some other ideas about shape-shifting and things like that. And all of this just really scratches the surface. It doesn't get into the questions of, you know, whether or not, you know, do mythical transformations qualify as shape-shifting? So if Zeus becomes a swan, is that to say, is that shape-shifting in the same way that we would think of as werewolves being shape-shifters and things like that? So there's a lot that we could say on the subject that we just haven't yet. And are we going to... I don't know that we'll be revisiting it anytime soon. Hopefully the next thing you hear from us will be our holiday episodes for Yuletide. And then we've got other wonderful shows that we've sort of been outlining and lining up. So I think if you're listening for more shapeshifting, it's going to be a little bit longer before we come back to the topic. But for now, I hope that these have been a pair of interesting and useful episodes. These episodes are made possible because we have some really, really wonderful people supporting us. And they support us by going to patreon.com/newworldwitchery. And, you know, doing that helps us out. You can pledge as little as a dollar a month and get some cool rewards. The bookbinding deal that you heard about in this episode and the last episode that went out. People at our Patreon supporters knew about that first. So if you want to know about stuff first, you can pledge a dollar a month and get our newsletter and find out new things that are happening with us before anyone else. Whatever you can give, we appreciate that. So please don't hesitate to just jump in. Whatever you feel comfortable with works for us. We do like to thank those who support us at the producer level by name. So I wanted to give special thanks to Diana Garino, Renee Otters, Ye Old Magic Shop, Raven Darkmoon, Ivory, The Witch's View Podcast, Sarah, Molly, Athena Beth, and Jen Rue of Rue and Hyssop, all of whom have really gone above and beyond to help make our show just even better. Again, you're getting a second episode this month. And if you're a Patreon subscriber, you actually probably got this episode a little before it was on iTunes. So, it's wonderful to get that support. It's wonderful to know that that we're doing something that you value. So please head on over to Patreon and give us a bump there if you can. If you can't and you just you still want to help out, please share us on social media. Let people know. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Links are in our show notes and on our website. Our website is newworldwitchery.com. You can reach us by email at compassandkey@gmail.com. Facebook is facebook.com/newworldwitchery. Twitter is @NWWitchery if you're trying to reach us there. And we do, we do try to interact with all of those accounts, make sure that we are communicating with everybody as best we can. So, please do stop by those places. We love to hear from you. Also, if you want to help out again and you aren't in a place to do anything financial, that's totally cool. We get that. We appreciate, people just emailing us and telling us that they like what we're doing, sharing their folklore, things like that. You can also hop over onto iTunes and leave us a review there. That helps boost our visibility and let people know that we're here. So that's also a great way to just sort of let us know what you're thinking about us and about what we're doing here. That being said, I think that's plenty of talking for tonight, and thank you so much for listening. I hope these shape-shifting episodes have been good for you, have been worthwhile for you, and with all that being said, I hope you're all preparing for a joyous holiday season. We'll be back again before the end of December with our Yuletide episode, or episodes, perhaps. I guess until then, thanks for listening, and be well.